Call this meeting of the Labor and Industry Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today, February 28th. I'm getting ahead of myself here. Representative Mecklen, did you get a chance to look at the minutes? You're going to be my minute guy.
Yeah, at least I get something to ask every week.
Right? Yeah.
I have looked at the minutes, and I moved the minutes.
Representative Mecklen moves approval of the minutes from February 21st, 2023. Hearing a horn going off. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion prevails.
Yes.
First bill we have on the agenda today, and it's a little different than what the posted agenda says, but is House File 1551, Representative Newton. And I'll move House File 1551. It's going to General Register. And there's an amendment for this bill. And it's, if you want to explain your amendment, Representative Newton.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing this bill. The amendment simply adds word class for licensed electricians employed by a class, and then changes the date from 2030 to 2028.
So I'll move the A1 amendment. Put the bill in the order the author would like. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. You got the bill the way the author wants. Explain your bill, Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1551 expands the current exemption in law regarding the required inspections for most types of electrical work. Electric utilities, including rural co-ops, are exempt from inspections by Dolly or local government when they do work on their generating, transmission, and metering facilities. House File 1551 adds a utilities load control system as another that would not require an inspection when some electrical work is done. The bill further provides that load control work must be performed by a licensed electrician employed by a Class A electrical contractor for repair or replacement of existing equipment by a rural co-op or municipal utility, and thirdly, be completed by the end of 2028. This is an agreement among stakeholders, including the IBEW, electric co-ops, municipal utilities, Department of Labor and Industry. It's been going on for several years, and we finally have peace in the valley. Last year in the Senate, this bill passed by 66-0, even though the Senate's not a great reference in this committee, but just to let you know.
I won't do like Representative Nash did this morning, call you Senator. That would be a demotion.
Yeah. So, we have a testifier here also, Mr. Chair, that I'd like to have say a few words.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and members of the committee, for the opportunity to be here to testify on House File 1551, Representative Newton's bill regarding the inspection during the replacement of load control receivers on behalf of the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. MRAA is a statewide association for electric cooperatives that represents 50 of the cooperatives within the state of Minnesota, covering all the counties. My name is Ron Meyer. I am the CEO of McLeod Cooperative Power. We are a not-for-profit cooperative with just over 7,000 member owners. We have over 3,000 load control receivers, and we're in the process of upgrading them over the next couple of years. Load control receivers allow utilities to reduce demand for electricity during peak hours. They control electrical loads like water heaters, air conditioners, and other major electrical devices. They are foundational for the safe and reliable operation of the grid today and into the future. At MCPA, our load control program reduces our consumers' demand at critical times, which helps reduce emissions, the cost of electricity, while maintaining the reliability of the electric grid. When load control receivers are initially installed, the work is done by a licensed electrician and the work is inspected. We replace load control receivers when they die or when they become obsolete. Looking ahead, hundreds of thousands of these units will need to be replaced in the coming years in Minnesota. Representative Newton's bill proposes a functional solution while avoiding unnecessary costs and maintaining the safe maintenance of the devices. We appreciate and thank the stakeholders, including the IBEW and the Department of Labor and Industry, for coming together on this agreement. This bill will ensure safety, lower costs, and help the energy transition that the Minnesota Electric Cooperative have been doing towards for the past couple of years. Low control receivers are an important tool in our toolbox as we transition into a lower carbon future. Along with solar and wind backed by storage, low control programs supported by these receivers will continue to be critical in our efforts for the future. Low control programs are a well-established tool that we've been using to keep the grid safe, reliable, and cost affordable. Representative Newton's bill offers peace of mind for both the utility and the consumers. The utility can continue to maintain their equipment, and homeowners can feel rest assured that problems are being addressed and work is being done by qualified personnel. Thank you for this opportunity, and I'm here to answer any questions that might come up.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to speak for or against House File 1551? If not, we'll go to questions. Questions from the members. See no hands jumping up. Looks like you've got peace in the valley even here.
Good.
Representative Newton, you want to do a wrap-up then?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you all. And I would like to ask if you and Lead McDonald agree that we move this to the consent agenda.
Representative McDonald, I guess I'm not exactly sure how that works. So are you okay with putting it to the consent calendar or?
Mr. Chair, I was a supporter of the consent agenda, but I don't know if I have the authority to consent to it today, but certainly something we should look into.
We will, we'll make the motion was to send it to the general register, and we'll take it up with rules about putting it on the consent calendar. I think it's got, that's done in rules. So, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative McDonald.
So with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1551 as amended, be re-referred to the general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it, the motion prevails. Next bill we have is also Representative Newton, and House File 1690, 826, I've got them wrong here, am I looking at the wrong number here? 826. And I understand we have an amendment to this also. Is this one-word amendment?
One-word amendment, yes, Mr. Chair.
And this came in a little late, and I checked it with Representative McDonald yesterday. He said, okay, it's just adding the word wage, or rate. Yeah, rate after the word wage.
That's correct.
So I'll move House File 826 to have it in front of us, and then I'll move the A2 amendment. And again, it's just adding one word, the word rate after the word wage on page 5, line 29. Any questions about the amendment? If not, all in favor of the A2 amendment to put the bill in the form the author wants, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment's been adopted. Representative Newt, explain your bill.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 826 passed the Energy and Climate Committee with bipartisan support, and it has bipartisan authors on the bill. This is a bill that simply requires construction projects that are fully or partially funded with appropriations from the renewable development account are subject to the state's prevailing wage requirements and must pay workers a prevailing wage as established by the Department of Labor and Industry.
We have testifiers on this bill, too. At least I got two testifiers on the bill. Mr. Snope, I see you made it over from the Senate. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, and thanks for moving things around a little bit for us to run over here and testify. My name is Andy Snope. I am the legislative director for IBW Local 292. We represent 5,000 electrical workers in our jurisdiction, and today I'm also speaking on behalf of the other 14,000 IBW workers who work throughout the state of Minnesota in the electrical industry. We are here today to speak in support of House File 826 as amended. As stated in Statutes 17741, it is public interest that public buildings and other public works be constructed and maintained by the best means and highest quality of labor reasonably available, and that persons working on those public works be compensated accordingly to the real value of the services they perform. It is therefore the policy of the state that wages of laborers, workers, and mechanics on the projects financed in whole or part by the state funds should be comparable to wages paid for similar work in the community as a whole. This policy has been long in place for the state of Minnesota public funds spent on construction projects. We believe it is long past due that the same policy is applied to construction type projects funded by the Renewable Development Account. The Renewable Development Account Fund was originally established through the legislation in 1994 as a deal worked out between Prairie Island Community, then NSP, and the state of Minnesota in exchange for the storage of spent fuel in casks at their facility near the Prairie Island Community. Legislation, which began as a one-paragraph statute, has now since become a full paragraph and page of programs that has been used to fund renewable energy research and projects not only in XL Energy Territory, but throughout the state of Minnesota. In more recent times, this fund has become a legislative discretionary spending source for renewable energy ideas. Almost every renewable energy project and incentive program proposed as a renewable energy account spending mechanism in it. The RDA fund walks and talks like general fund money spending, and for that reason, we think it's long overdue for the fund to carry the same public works, wages, and hourly policies that come with general fund spending. In 2013, legislative session was the year that the state legislature began a stronger focus on renewable energy and carbon reduction. Enacting legislation to promote and incentivize the development of alternative energy moving from legacy energy sources. More solar and wind and less coal and natural gas. Well-paying and great benefited jobs began to disappear as legacy power plants began to shut down. While the IBEW's well-trained and diverse construction workforce evolved through this planning phase, and we are always ready to meet that challenge of a changing industry, we also saw a lot of job loss suffered by our brothers and sisters in the legacy power producing industry. While we watched those in our industry lose their jobs, more frustration came for workers in the electrical construction industry when, driven by incentives and grants, out-of-state renewable energy developers flooded the state of Minnesota in search of high profits. This resulted in a race to the bottom for wages and benefits in the renewable energy market. The contractors we work for found it difficult to compete. These out-of-state developers were able to dominate the industry with low-paying wages and benefits that they paid traveling workers from other economic markets around the country. These workers and developers took these investments and left the state of Minnesota's economy to spend the money elsewhere. Just in the last few years, we have been able to draw more attention to this issue. We have worked with the PUC and legislators to recognize local hiring, apprenticeship training, and legacy plant job loss that has shifted through our industry. Further, providing a proven public policy of prevailing wage requirements around renewable energy development account spending is just another piece of the puzzle to promote great careers and a strong economy when we promote renewable energy. Please support House File 826 as amended. And thank you very much for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Snow. Do you want to hang around if there's any questions?
Yes, sir.
The next person on my list is Kevin Pranus. I don't think he's here. Anybody else in the audience that needs to testify for or against this bill? If not, we'll go to discussion. Any member questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Newton, regarding the prevailing wage, is there a thought of the cost increases that this could occur if this bill becomes law?
Well, you know, that's really not, excuse me, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Representative Newton.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McDonald. What we're looking at is making sure that when we have someone go out and work on a job, that they're paid an appropriate wage, that we don't bring people in to do jobs on things like solar, where it has happened in the past, and they haven't been paid appropriately for the work that they're doing. This is a semi-government program, basically. Renewable Development Account has become that over time, and so it should be the same as any other program that we have that's administered by the state.
Representative,
I don't know if I have completely answered that, Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Newton. Well, you did, certainly, and I recognize and understand the prevailing wage and the fact that you have qualified folks on the job site, certainly, and we also recognize the importance of the union and the workers who are really concentrated on safety and job safety and expertise, but so, too, is the same with any private companies as well. Their emphasis on safety of their employees is very important. But there's no doubt that any time we deal with prevailing wage, that the cost of the projects do increase significantly, especially on state programs. So I would believe that you would probably agree with me that this would increase the cost of any projects and most likely perhaps be passed on by ratepayers in the future. Wouldn't you say that could be the case?
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, I don't agree with that, actually. I think that most studies have shown that whether prevailing wage is indicated or not, that the employees are paid roughly the same. There might be a difference in benefits, but when it comes to jobs, as you know right now, the labor market is really tight. And to find anyone other than possibly undocumented workers, it would be very difficult to go ahead with a project and not pay what is the prevailing wage.
And Representative Donald, I'm going to interrupt you here. I see Mr. Prentice has come.
Okay.
We'll let him come speak, and then we'll continue with the questioning. Again, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, committee members. My name is Kevin Prentice, and I'm here on behalf of Liuna, Minnesota, North Dakota. We represent 29,000 skilled construction laborers and family members and work on a wide variety of projects, including energy, building, and civil infrastructure projects. We're happy to be here today in support of this important bill. And I think as many representatives here know, we've been a strong supporter of a beneficial clean energy transition. But to us, that means that the jobs should be just as good and just as available to local workers as the jobs have been in the conventional energy sector, which has supported many families, thousands of households for generations in Minnesota. And the RDA prevailing wage is a step in that direction. I would also point out that it's consistent with the policies. If we think about the RDA as money collected from ratepayers by Xcel, if Xcel were spending that money, whether it's on a power plant or other infrastructure that's needed for the utility system, those workers would be earning prevailing wage, and we don't think it makes sense for the legislature to be dispersing that money, creating lower quality jobs. We think all of these jobs should be high quality jobs. I would also point out, I think it's a fair question what the cost impact is. So the most, say the gold standard for research on prevailing wage costs was done right here in Minnesota. It was a natural sample that looked at school construction, where schools may choose to use prevailing wage or not use prevailing wage, including schools next door to each other doing comparable projects. That study, which was, again, the most comprehensive probably in the nation, concluded that there was no meaningful impact on front-end costs. And that's actually quite significant, because where we often see the real benefits are on the long term, in terms of avoiding cost overruns, avoiding change orders, avoiding delays in the schedule. And so without even including all of those benefits, there was no difference in front-end cost, which is critically important. And there's a lot of question about why that is. And I think the reason is contractors that pay prevailing wage, whether they're union or non-union, because there are many successful non-union contractors that pay prevailing wage rates, invest in their workforce and they have greater efficiency. They do things right the first time rather than having to repeat and do rework. And so you see comparable bid prices on the front end and far better results in terms of whether it's workers' pay and benefit, having health care and pensions, reduced reliance on public assistance, more of that money stays in the community, and more of the contractors are local. All of that's really been well documented, so we think it's an appropriate step to take and appreciate the committee's consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Prince. Representative McDonald, do you have any more?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I appreciate the information that you shared with us as well, and I realize the bill has bipartisan support. I just had a couple questions regarding if there were some cost increases, of course, and some of the nuances of the bill, some of the record keeping for smaller businesses. Should that become an onerous on the business owners and small contractors? And I think it was a legitimate question, and I certainly appreciate your response as well.
Representative Schultz, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Newton. I just want to start by first with a thank you to both of you. Representative Newton, I believe that this is the right policy for the state of Minnesota, and you've done good work on this bill and to bring the stakeholders. And you, Mr. Chair, it's pretty advantageous of us to have great participation today from IBEW, some of our greatest workers across the state on what I believe is their day on the Hill. So welcome to each and every one of you. We're grateful to have you. And let me just say this. This legislature, as has been mentioned in your letter from IBEW as well, through the course of this legislative session, this legislature, this House of Representatives, has disproportionately impacted you and your jobs through House File 7 and through the destruction of the legacy energy sources that we've had here in Minnesota for a long time. And it's about time that we stand up for union men and women in this state through a bill just like this, because right now in Minnesota, the development and the advancement of solar panels and wind turbines and others across the state take away from the jobs that you guys go to work in right now. And so it's important that we pass this bill today to support your jobs here in Minnesota, especially with the advance of House File 7.
Didn't hear a question there. Any other questions, comments? Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate both of you. And given sort of the prior comments, I'm sort of wondering, as we think about how this fits into the work you talked about, can't remember if it was you, Mr. Snope, or Mr. Prentice, but how this is going to fit into the work of ensuring that as we move our economy forward and move to a clean energy economy that we have good jobs. I'm wondering if you could talk about, to that point, about House File 7 and your position on that and how we can do this, those two things in a complementary way.
And just remind you, Mr. Prentice, go ahead, but I just remind people we're debating here House File 826, and so Mr. Prentice.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Representative Greenman, I'll try to stick to the 826 question, but I think so. One thing that we can say is that with House File 7, we established prevailing wage requirements for large energy projects, large wind and solar projects that are permitted by the Public Utilities Commission. Typically, the projects funded through the Renewable Development Account are different scale and types of projects, but with a similar goal. They might be energy generation, they might be energy efficiency projects, but they're all moving toward that same goal of delivering the energy that's needed in order to live our lives without, while reducing those carbon emissions. And so I think that these match up fairly well with the policy there. It's certainly true that, we've had a lot of good, what have been prevailing wage jobs in conventional power plants. I think the most important thing for us is all the jobs should be good jobs, right? That we should be committed that in this transition, we're not moving from better jobs to worse jobs. Some of the places are different. That imposes some challenges for members, but I think we've never tried to say what kind of energy the state should have. We've tried to say what kind of jobs we think the state should have and how we can meet that. And we appreciate the bipartisan support for that and concern and recognition of the quality of the old jobs, but also the potential quality for the new jobs.
Thank you, Mr. Prentice. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Prentice.
Any further questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to publicly thank the IBEU for the reception last night at Mancini's. What did I say?
You.
IBEW, the electricians, Sparkies. Hey, I'm Irish. We can misspeak once in a while. Anyway, it was a lovely event, and what it does is it brings both sides of the aisles together. I've been down here 13 years, and these kind of functions, Representative Chair Nelson, you'll agree, brings us together, and we get to know each other. I get to know more of my friends on the other side. You got to know some of us. And but for those great receptions of your organizations, we would be less of a good working governance down here at the Capitol. So thank you for a great reception. I know you're in the room today, Joel. Thank you.
Any further questions or comments? If not, I'll renew my motion, and I'll just say before I do that, my father-in-law was an IBEW 160 member, worked for NSP for 31 years, so life was raised on those salaries, those good salaries. Anyway, I'll renew my motion that House File 826, as amended, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill's on its way.
Thank you.
The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 1690, Representative Jordan. And this is going out to, state government. And this needs to go to state government. And Representative Jordan, when you get ready, you want to make a motion? And we'll give the room a chance to clear out so we can quiet down. And Representative Jordan, if you want to make the motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1690 be re-referred to the State and Local Government Committee, and I also have a DE as well that I would like to attach to the bill to get the bill in the shape I'd like. And I will go through the bill. Once the amendment is on, I will note the changes to the underlying bill as I walk through it.
That would be great. There's a DE amendment to members, and that's put in the order that the author would like. So make your motion to the DE1 amendment.
I move the DE1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
DE1 amendment's in front of us. And if you want to, before we vote on the amendment, if you want to go through and explain, this is the bill, but describe the bill and describe the amendment.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'd prefer to walk through the bill and the amendment in its entirety.
You can do it all at once.
Yeah.
All in favor of the DE1 amendment, then?
Aye.
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 Opposed? The bill's in the order we want. Representative Jordan, explain your bill and the differences between the original bill and the DE.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, as Minnesotans, we are proud of our state and the standard of living we strive to provide for all of our residents. But right now, our laws are not keeping up with the times to ensure that our public servants have the support they need to keep all Minnesotans of all ages educated, safe, and healthy. The Public Employee Labor Relations Act, or PELRA, was passed in 1984. Other than creating the Public Employee Relations Board, or the PERB, Mr. Chair, as you're well aware, and adding or subtracting bargaining units, PELRA has not seen significant changes since at least the 1990s. The stagnation in our public sector labor laws has eroded the ability of public employees to join together to have a voice on the job. That hurts all of us. House File 1690 strengthens the voice of public employees and their freedom to choose to join together in a union while modernizing how public employees can work together with their union. House File 1960 also adds essential clarifications to, 1690, also adds essential clarifications to the rights and responsibilities of public employers, public employees, and their unions, with some of those clarifications needed following the 2018 U.S. Supreme Court decision in Janus, overturning the Supreme Court's original position in Bood from 40 years earlier. This bill recognizes that we are well into the age of electronic data and communication. It addresses the need to protect workers' personal information maintained by public employers. The first parts of Section 1 and 15, the previous Section 12, ensure that unions have access to up-to-date contact information for the public employees in the bargaining unit and in an electronic format so unions can meet their obligations to represent those public employees on the job. Remember, no one can be required to join a union, but unions are required to represent all employees, whether they are a member or not. Part 16, which was the previous part, Section 13, allows workers and their union to communicate about workplace issues using work emails, while the second part of Section 1 and Section 20, the previous Section 14, protect the private information of workers maintained by their employers, including communications between a worker and their union. And parts of the new Sections 11 and 8 and 18 provide for the use of electronic signatures that we have allowed for a number of other provisions over the past 20 years. The new Section 2, which lies within the jurisdiction of the State and Local Government Committee, would keep state employees whole in the event of any future government shutdowns, which happen through no fault of these public employees. The provisions in Sections 3, 5, 6, and 7 were all in the underlying bill, but are also in the jurisdiction of the Education Policy Committee, which is hearing these provisions tomorrow. Sections 4, 8, and 9, the previous 3, 7, and 8, make changes to which public school employees are covered by PELRA and incorporate House File 1161, which we passed out of this committee on February 16th, thanks to the work of Representative Wolgamott. Every worker should join a union. Section 10, previously 9, and the new Section 13 add staffing as it relates to workload and student testing to the terms and conditions of employment over which public sector workers and their employers may bargain. Section 11 is an addition to the bill that adds clarity to the existing right, not obligation, of public employees to contribute to their union out of the wages they've earned through their labor, as well as the responsibilities of both the public employers and the union with regard to those contributions. This includes the union having sole liability for any errors. Section 12, the previous Section 10, clarifies that public employers and public sector unions had the right to operate in good faith, relying on decades of state law and U.S. Supreme Court precedent before the decision in 2018 with Janus. Section 14, the previous Section 11, adds union affiliates, such as the AFL-CIO, to the union itself when it comes to reasonable time off to serve as an organizational officer within that union or affiliate. Having already mentioned and gone through the email provision in the amended Section 16, which is the previous Section 13, the remainder of this section ensures that public sector unions can fulfill their responsibility to work on behalf of all members of the bargaining unit by providing for the two-way communication between public employees and their union on workplace issues. The new Sections 17 and 19 provide for majority verification, aka card check, of a new public sector bargaining unit, while the new Section 18 matches up the timeline for submitting public worker signatures with the one-year timeline in the private sector. And before we move to testimony, I want to make sure that members know that this bill guarantees no outcomes. Employees and employers must still negotiate. This bill merely gives workers a voice on the job the way PELRA was intended. And with that, I would like to proceed to testimony and discussion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. And before we get started, Ms. James, there are parts of the bill that I know go to other committees that aren't in our jurisdiction. Which would be the ones that we should focus on for our committee here? Do you have a list of that?
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, I don't have a list of that, but I'm happy to look at that right now. I know Representative Jordan mentioned Section 2, for example, would be a state gov issue, but I have to look at it more specifically.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, as we go through it, I can clarify which sections would go to which portions of the bill. But there are two versions of this bill. There is House File 1690, which is the bill before us in this committee. There is a clone version of this bill entitled 1691. That bill is currently in education policy and will be traveling to the Judiciary Committee, where those two committees will examine the parts of the bill that examine education policy specifically and judiciary in that committee. This bill also is traveling from here to state and local government. I don't know the entirety. That's a very long committee name. But it's going to Chair Cleaborn's committee, where we will look at some of those issues as it pertains to state and local government.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. And Ms. James, if you can look at that, just so we can keep our we've got an hour here left to go in the meeting, so we've got plenty of time. But if we can keep it limited to what is our responsibility here in labor. So, Representative Jordan, if you want to,
Mr. Chair,
Representative McDonald, do you have a question? Or
I do, yes, for Representative Jordan, and certainly recognize the importance of just sticking to our jurisdiction and the portions of the bill. As I look at the list of testifiers, are they too going to stick just to the portions of the bill? It looks as though your testifiers are really should be testifying on the education policy explicitly and not this section, but I could be incorrect. I wanted to get the clarification on that.
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, the testifiers will give their testimony, and that is up to them. I do think it is important that we're listening to the voice of educators in the Labor Committee because we're examining a lot of the labor conditions that these educators go through. And then some of the more specific questions, I would think around non-mandated standardized testing, for example, and the utility or lack thereof would be something that would be better examined in the Education Policy Committee. But examining educators or nutrition workers or bus drivers as it pertains to education would be more within the Labor Committee. But I could be corrected by the chair if that is incorrect.
And we sometimes give latitude here, and we don't have control. But like I said, we've got time, but if we as members can limit ourselves to the what's in our jurisdiction, that would be helpful in getting through the rest of the meeting. So, Representative Jordan, you want to have your testifiers come up, and we'll go, and I think I have a list here, and start out with this. I've got my list, Greta Callahan. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Nelson. My name is Greta Callahan. I am a kindergarten teacher on leave from the Minneapolis Public Schools, currently serving as president of the teacher chapter of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. I'm also the mother of a student in our district, and I'm here today to testify in support of House File 1690. While there are several portions of the bill that I believe will improve the quality of education in both Minneapolis schools and Minnesota as a whole, my time is short and I'd like to focus on two sections. First, Section 4 of the amendment would allow Tier 1 teachers and early learning educators to join the same union that represents Tiers 2, 3, and 4 teachers in the school district, if those Tier 1 teachers choose to do so. Many of our Tier 1 teachers in Minneapolis are Black, Indigenous, and people of color who come from communities that have been historically disadvantaged and oppressed. In my role, I spend each day in a different building talking to teachers in Minneapolis, and every day our Tier 1 teachers ask me what they need to do to join our unit. They share examples of why they are so desperately in need of the same protections that their peers have. Allowing them to join with the other teachers in their work sites will be empowering, raise their pay, and give our Tier 1 teachers more protections against discrimination in the workplace. Bringing them into our larger union will also make MFT and unions like ours more effective advocates for all our teachers and communities by adding new voices and fresh perspectives to our union's deliberations and bargaining goals. I'd also like to highlight Section 10 of the amendment of the bill, which would expand the mandatory subjects of bargaining to include class sizes, testing, and student-to-personnel ratios. As you may know, MFT and many other unions of educators have been raising these issues at the bargaining table for several years, always over the protests of negotiators on the other side who believe these subjects should stay the prerogatives of management. They are wrong. Our schools are not businesses. Our students are not market share. They are humans who all deserve a world-class education. This isn't about me trying to teach 40 kids. It's about 40 kids needing to learn at one time in one room. They deserve individualized attention, differentiated instruction, small groups, and the ability to develop relationships with their teachers and classmates. That's impossible when we have kids sitting on wall heaters because there isn't enough space to add more chairs in the classroom. When maximum class sizes or counselor to student ratios are put in the contract, it's enforceable and it's a promise to everyone about how that school will operate for the next 2 years. It's a promise parents can count on when they're making enrollment decisions. It's a promise educators can look to when they're making career choices. It's a sure sign to students about how much their school cares for them. Without contract language, those promises mean nothing, which is detrimental to our students' education. I support House File 1690. I believe the provisions in the bill and those under discussion will improve learning conditions in our schools, give parents some welcome clarity about how their children's schools will operate, and strengthen the labor movement. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Callahan. The next person I have on my list is, and if you want to hang around if there's questions for you, is Jennifer Early. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Early. I'm an attorney at Ratwick, Rozak, and Maloney, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, the Minnesota Rural Education Association, and the Association of Secondary School Principals and the Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association. They've all asked me to come here today for the various reason of addressing some of the concerns with House File Number 1690. Minnesota School Boards Association in particular has been a long-standing representative of multiple forums that have the voice of the schools. Through the courts, through the legislature, they've always had an input in these types of issues. And their stakeholders and a number of the issues that are being raised in this bill today. While MSBA hasn't had the opportunity, and some of our partners have also not have had a complete opportunity to collaborate with the authors of this bill, we are in an attempt to try to do this, to coordinate and address our concerns. But in the interim, this has come before the committee, and we feel the need to address some of the key points that relate to labor that we feel that need to be addressed in House File 1690. So I would like to go through a few of those. The first one, and one of the most important to some of the schools that I've been asked to address, are the proposed changes to the composition of our teaching staff. We feel that some of these changes will negatively affect the quality of education. And one specific example is the change from the probationary period of 120 days to 60 days. This probationary periods that run throughout the types of employment situations that we deal with, are very specific to teachers. They're put in place for a very specific reason. This 60-day to 120-day is a big change. It happened 12 years ago in our Senate, or in our legislature. At that point in time, we had 60 days in for a very short period of time. It didn't work. There's a very good reason why a 60-day probationary period does not work for teachers. We have an extensive evaluation process that school districts are required to follow. It's for the purpose of evaluating the teacher's skills, and it significantly affects the employment of teachers. If you do not have an appropriate period of time to address the teaching skills and evaluation of your employees, you can't tell whether or not you're going to be renewing or non-renewing them. The teachers do not get adequate consideration if we don't have that time in place, and the schools don't have the ability to evaluate the skills. This will not increase the employability of teachers. It will have a negative effect on their employment and their ability to be renewed in the schools. A second major concern that we've already somewhat addressed here today is the data privacy issues and some of the other considerations that relate to the sharing of data between an individual employee and the schools and their unions. This is also something that significantly affects schools. It's not just the ability to have unions connect with their employees. It relates to the issues that schools also have with their employees. We're being asked as an entity that is being given the trust of this information to share this data with unions. Employees aren't given a say necessarily as to what private data of theirs is going to be shared, who they have to meet with, when they have to meet with, and the bill doesn't address those individual privacy concerns. We would ask for consideration of those issues. And third, and perhaps the most imperative issue that MSBA wishes to address, and probably one of the most of concern to this committee, is the inherent managerial rights that appear to be diminished in this bill. There's a long-standing governing structure for school boards that has been vested through the legislature and through the courts that schools are in a position to independently govern. We're elected by our communities. Those are not only members of our community, but our parents and our staff members. They run our schools. And schools have been recognized to have the general control and charge of the business and interests of schools. Courts have similarly recognized that because schools are comprised of our taxpayers, our community members, and our parents, that they are the entities that should have the decision-making authority in schools. And these don't mold well with having multiple individuals involved in some of the decisions. Some of these decisions will require that we are negotiating issues with staff ratios, class sizes. These are not a cookie cutter type of situation that go for all schools. Minnesota schools are all across our nation. They're not just in our metro. And not all of these ratios, not all of these changes that are designed specifically to affect schools and not necessarily all entities within the state of Minnesota are being affected. But they are going to affect schools. And we're going to have to negotiate and address grievances in contracts that are stuck for 2 years that we don't have an ability to reopen, that we don't have an ability to address on the dime. And that doesn't bode well for schools who sometimes have to react to situations that arise without notice and without the ability to change things that are written in stone. For these reasons, we would ask for consideration of these issues, a chance to address the multiple issues that have been raised in this bill. And I would like to thank the committee and Mr. Chairman to be considering our issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hurley. And FYI, the data privacy issues that will be taken discussed in judiciary. That's not one that's before this. That's normally before this committee. But thank you for your testimony. The next person I have on my list is Dr. Michael Lovett, and then after that I have Scott Helen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Nelson.
State your name and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Michael Lovett, and I'm appearing on behalf of, in support of, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, MASA, and speaking to a portion of the bill. My testimony will pertain to an item on page 2 of the of 1690, which you received today. It's at the bottom. Section 120A, 414, subdivision 2, which currently allows a school board to adopt an e-learning day plan after consulting with the exclusive representative of the teachers. My remarks, they will be brief, but the case I will make is that the 2022 language is appropriate for this topic, and we urge you not to make adoption of an e-learning day plan subject to the requirement of meeting and negotiating with the exclusive representative. I'll make 4 points. First of all, very basic, what is e-learning? Under the same statute, an e-learning day means a school day where a school offers full access to online instruction provided by students' individual teachers due to inclement weather. We are in Minnesota, and you know what the last month has been like. Secondly, what is the practical meaning of consulting with the exclusive representative of the teachers, or commonly called meeting and conferring, prior to the time a school board can adopt an e-learning plan? Under Pell Route, which you're familiar with in this committee, the obligation to meet and confer rather than meet and negotiate is, and I quote from a Minnesota court case, which I can provide the citation to the committee, is designed to encourage close cooperation between public employers and professional employees by providing for discussion and mutual exchange for ideas. In my professional experience, nearly 40 years of school leadership in Minnesota, meet and confer is marked by regular and frequent conversations over time where employees and school leaders learn to understand and trust one another, building relationships over time that allows the parties to promptly address emerging and urgent issues such as this. In contrast, what does it mean to require meeting and negotiating with the exclusive representative of the teachers? Meeting and negotiating means reaching agreement on whatever the exclusive representative might believe is important before boards can adopt a plan. In this case, with e-learning, that might include limits on the number of students served, the compensation, the curriculum, even the frequency of e-learning days, which may be inadequate given unknown circumstances in our future, including weather, which is sort of known, but another pandemic or other situations. Finally, why is the standard of consulting with the exclusive representative of teachers the appropriate standard for employee involvement and engagement prior to the time that a school board adopts an e-learning plan? First, school boards need flexibility to meet the needs of students and families to address staff and student safety on a timely basis while fulfilling the statutory and ethical responsibilities for students and their learning. As in the case with the adoption of the school calendar, a board has a statutory obligation to meet and listen to the preferences of teachers and, in practice, extend this respect to other employees as well as parents and other stakeholders. And if any of you find yourself complaining about the challenges of getting agreement in the legislature, I would encourage you to sit on a school calendar committee and listen to all the stakeholders' points of view before the school board has to make a decision on the school calendar for the following year. As trustees, the school board must balance the needs of constituent stakeholders and make a wise and timely decision. Consider the challenges of our era, a pandemic, caution on the part of parents to send their children to in-person school for this and other reasons pertaining to safety and travel time. These and other pressures require school leaders and boards to be flexible, innovative, responsive, and prompt in making and adjusting e-learning plans. Remember, as you understand Pell Route, there's already an obligation of the school district to meet and negotiate over wages, hours, and other conditions of employment every 2 years during the regular collective bargaining process. That means that in the case of e-learning plans, the parties may agree to provisions that pertain to e-learning, but that is a very different matter than requiring a negotiated settlement prior to adopting a plan. So in summary, the current language, consulting with the exclusive representative of the teachers, is the appropriate standard for teacher involvement and engagement on this important issue. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you for your, if you want to hang around. If there are any questions, we'll call you back up. The next I have Scott Helland. Again, welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record and proceed your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Scott Velland. I'm a member of the Literacy Action Network and a coordinator in adult education. Literacy Action Network is a statewide professional membership organization whose mission is to develop, improve, expand adult literacy services by coordinating public policy advocacy, fostering statewide collaboration, and supporting quality adult basic education. This bill recognizes the professionalism and hard work of teachers in the field of adult education. LAN is in favor of teachers being paid in a similar way to our K-12 counterparts. Most adult education professionals have a K-12 license rather than a specific adult education licensure. However, K-12 and adult education are funded in very, very different methods. Without an addition to funding to go with this mandate, our shared goal of having teachers be paid like their K-12 counterparts while working in a system that is funded at a much different rate would cause the system to break. 83% of the adult education budget for a program in the metro area is currently like wages and salaries. Adult education programs run year round, which is different than their K-12 partners. If the teachers were switched from current ABE hours to K-12 teacher time for a K-12 contract, that's a big service difference. That means if a program wants a teacher to teach the same amount of hours, the program would have to pay like 133% of whatever they end up on the teaching scale just based on the hours of service to students. If adult ed teachers have this shift to K-12 pay scale without changing the funding of adult education, there has to be an adjustment to the budget somewhere for these additional costs. That would be 20 to 33% of an increase in programming budgets. Without an addition to the funding system, there's little wiggle room when 83% of the adult education budget is staff wages and salaries. There'll be limited budgets, limited options on how to balance the budget. Perhaps there'd be fewer ABE teachers, perhaps the same number of teachers, but they would have fewer hours. Perhaps there'd be program cuts serving less adult learners. None of these methods serve our clients better. The math doesn't work to deliver the same amount of service to students with the same funding. Currently, also 73% of the state's programs for adult education are school district programs, but 27% are not, which wouldn't be affected in this bill. And it does create a division of school district and non-school district programs in Minnesota. Currently, it's been since 2014 that adult education has seen a cost of living increase to funding to the system besides one-time money, which can't be used to pay wages and salaries. Adult education programs are focused on serving the needs of students to include English, GED, HISET, certified nursing assistant, IT career focus, paraprofessionals for schools, jobs in manufacturing and transportation, and the hours students need in class will be less if this bill passes without any additional funding, as 83% of the budget being salaries and wages cannot withstand these costs without additional funding. It is a win-win to have increased pay and increased funding for adult education, and Literacy Action Network has been an advocate for an increase in ABE staff for teachers and programs for years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Helland. And those seem to be all issues that will be discussed in the Education Committee, where part of this bill is going to. But thank you for your testimony. The next person I have, or the last person I have on my list, is Devin Bruce. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Devin Bruce. I'm the Public Affairs Coordinator for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, MAPE. We are a union of over 15,000 state employees across all Minnesota's agencies, boards, and commissions. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1690 as amended. In a broad sense, this bill amplifies the voices of workers in the public sector and modernizes many of the practices that PELRA is already currently authorized to do, but will also reflect the current trend towards a more digital and remote work environment. For example, allowing an electronic signature on membership certification or dues deduction card, a groundbreaking innovation codified in Minnesota law back in the year 2000. Permitting the use of work emails and technology for communication with workers related to work issues, such as grievances, arbitrations, MOUs, contract negotiations, et cetera. Ensuring that the data shared with the exclusive representatives are in an accessible and usable format. Many times we've seen just scanned pieces of paper with handwriting on it, and that's apparently acceptable, but that's not readable. many of the public employers currently have not returned to fully in-person work status. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but almost 30 to 40% of the state workforce is still in a remote or telework environment. And so the changes that are being proposed here will allow us as exclusive representatives to fully represent the employees in their work situations. This bill and many of its other provisions will also provide employees the ability to communicate with us on their workplace issues. The last part I wanted to lift up is a bill that we've been carrying for a long time, and that is to ensure that employees in the event of a government shutdown receive back pay. And while it doesn't currently touch on PELRA under the actual statutory definition, we usually have to go back and negotiate these through an MOU using PELRA and the contract negotiation process, and it varies agency by agency. So we can provide at least a standard form for all employees who are affected by a shutdown in the event of a non-appropriation, some type of economic security. So I thank you for your time and appreciate your support.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. And again, if you want to hang around if there are questions. I understand, Ms. Marty, you have a list of the areas that are our purview.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. So again, ultimately, the purview of the committee is in the discretion of the chair, so I would ultimately defer to you, Mr. Chair. For my quick review, as was noted by you and Representative Jordan, Section 1, and I'm for reference, I'm referring to the sections in the DE that was adopted. Sections 1 and 20 relate to data, specifically accessed by labor organizations. So that potentially could be something for judiciary or here. Again, that's up to the chair. Sections 3 through 7 are primarily related to education provisions and statutes that aren't typically heard in this committee. And then Sections 8 through 19, as well as 21, are direct changes to PELRA. PELRA is traditionally a statute that is under the labor's purview. And then also, like I mentioned before, Section 2 makes changes related to state employee salaries and benefits. Again, that is related to employment labor, but state employment labor, and so that typically would be a state government issue. Hopefully that helps, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Mark, Ms. James. With that, members, I'll open it up for discussion. Questions of the bill? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Jordan. For starters, my first point here is I have the DE1 amendment in front of me, and it's labeled across the top that it was available on February 25th at 11:59, yet it wasn't posted until days later and very nearly ahead of this committee. I understand it was within our rules, and I fully understand that, but it appears like it was available. And both for the public and for, obviously, us as members, it's helpful for us if we're able to digest this, as we've heard in this discussion, that we should just, especially with something that's, you know, I don't know, exact 15 pages long, that we're able to digest this with a little bit more time. So that was the first point that I wanted to make at this time, because there's several concerning provisions in this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, I think it's important to get things right. I like to take my time with bills that I'm putting my name on. So I worked on it and wanted to make sure it was right. It was posted within the rules and the traditions of this committee.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only follow-up to that is just simply that it was available, and we could have been working on this ahead of time, and I understand getting it right.
Mr. Chair, it was not available because it had not been signed off and reviewed by me.
Great. Do you recognize Representative Jordan? Any other discussion on the bill? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a thought regarding the amendment for all us lawmakers. It's not just about us. So when we say I wanted to get it right, it's not just about us. It really isn't. It's about those parties that are interested in it, those who are in education, those who care about the bill. You heard from testimony some folks that weren't aware of some of the changes in the DE2 amendment. So I just caution us that it's not about just me or I. It's about we as a state, as a legislature, and those interested parties, the shareholders, and people who are concerned about these issues. Certainly, Representative Jordan, you have every right to post within the rules and get it right, but I think we as lawmakers need to be courteous and not only getting it right, but giving the people who care about the issue opportunity to read the bill before it comes to its first stop. This will go to many different committees, probably two or three. There's ample time to get it right and notify the public of those changes. I just think it's good governance if we get it right, but with those interested parties who have the opportunity to read and learn about it before it comes to the first stop. I just think that's a good practice, but we're all have election certificates and we can certainly do what you think is best, but I think we're in it as a team. It's what, one Minnesota is what the governor says? But Representative Jordan, I'm trying to understand the bill and read through the 15 pages and find out what elements that really will get to the heart of improving our public education and helping the students with a better education. I haven't found it yet, but perhaps you can just share with us the necessity of the bill and what provisions in it will really do some good for the quality of our education and our students. And then I have a couple other questions, Mr. Chair.
I think for the record, you said DE2, but it's the DE1 amendment, just for the record to correct it. I know your tongue just kind of said the wrong thing. I understand that.
Duly noted.
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, our teachers' working conditions are our students' learning conditions. Teachers and educators and ESPs and bus drivers and cafeteria workers are advocating for students. By giving them a voice on the job, we're allowing them to advocate for the needs that their students have. Smaller class sizes help students. Getting them more individualized attention helps students. Making sure that teachers can have a say in how many assessments students take helps students. You know, this bill doesn't say that this could limit assessments. It could also put in place for teachers to say, hey, we really want to make sure our students are getting this other assessment so that we can better evaluate their working needs. Making sure that there are safe staffing ratios for hospitals helps patients. Making sure that trash haulers have a safe amount of routes to drive or people have the safe, right amount of snow to plow helps our residents, helps make sure that our streets are safe for residents. Making sure that our public employees who are working in corrections have safe staffing areas really helps the people that they serve as well. And just to remind you that this bill doesn't actually guarantee these outcomes, but it allows these workers who are taking care of our patients in hospitals, who are educating our children, who are hauling away our trash, have that voice on the job that they need to advocate for the people that they serve.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jordan, you certainly, I agree with you, certainly. I think what you said there makes some good sense. I don't think your bill quite does that, at least in my interpretations of it, but it's not all about me, right? I also listen to the testifiers who are better experts than I. So with your own words, the making it better for our educators and bus drivers and superintendents and our custodians, the probationary issue, which is a grave concern, that's one of the things that we talked about in a group a couple of days ago and was brought up here by Ms. Early, certainly does the opposite of what you just claimed to do by making it 60 days instead of 120 days. So I'm curious to what your thoughts are on that.
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, the probationary period is about making sure that there is an even amount. So right now, probationary times differ across the state, and so this would bring it into a standardization. I would be willing to determine what that is, but I think it's important that we have a standard probationary period across the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jordan, I agree with you. Certainly, that is a very important aspect. I would just ask you to consider listening to Mrs. Early and our concerns of maybe bringing it back to current law, which is 120 days probationary. As you heard from the testimony, who's an expert more so than us here, they did this, went back to 60 days a couple of years ago, and it just didn't work. So I think it probably is important to go to the 120 days of probationary based upon the expertise and my own superintendent who called me this morning to talk about this as well, or a couple of days ago.
And Representative Donald, that's in a section that's in the purview of education, but again, I'll give some latitude here, but that's...
I appreciate the latitude, Mr. Chair.
And that could something if you worked on when this bill or
It's cloned gets the education. I see we have someone coming up.
Mr. Chair, this is Meg Uger from Education Minnesota. She has she helped me put this bill together and has some more expertise on the probationary period and might be able to shed more light than I could.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Luger. If you want to state your name for the record and then maybe get help with the answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Meg Luger-Nicolai, Education Minnesota. And just a quick kind of the lay of the land right now is that for every teacher, they have to satisfy a three-year probationary period of 120 days each year. It did used to be 60 days. Before it was 60 days, it was like one day. There was no minimum. And so that increase actually occurred in fairly rapid succession. And I think the case for whether or not 120 or 60 days, or whether that increase in time has been a benefit to districts is really not necessarily been established. The second piece is that the change that this is requesting is actually twofold. One is to align districts that are cities of the first class with the rest of the state of Minnesota to ensure that everybody is serving a three-year period, but also to ensure that individuals who, by dint of parental leave, medical leave, or military leave, aren't having to repeat a year if they fall under that 120 days but are over 60 days. So we're really trying to ensure, you know, to balance the needs of districts to have an opportunity to evaluate folks, but also the needs of individuals to be human and have needs and also serve our country. So that's some of the rationale for that language.
Thank you, Ms. Luger. Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, I think that I would like to ask Ms. Early to come up from the Minnesota School Boards Association, and maybe if she's here to comment on that 60-day to the 120-day.
And it's Representative McDonald, it sounds like the Representative Jordan is willing to work on this, and maybe that's something that, as this goes forward, she can work on, and maybe when it gets to the floor, it'll be different than what it is. But again, this is perfect. Something that's in the education purview, and so, but Ms. Early, if you want to again tell us, state your name, and maybe you can help with the answer.
Yes, my name again, Jennifer Early, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association as well as about four or five other educational institutions that have an interest in these portions of the bill. May I answer a question that you had?
Yes, my question was testifier for the Minnesota, for the Education Minnesota, said that the 60 days is not necessary, the 120 days wasn't necessarily quantified as being the end-all and perfect number of days for probationary. But in your testimony, you said that the 60 days really didn't work and really needed the 120. So I wanted you just, if you could quantify that comment.
Sure, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. and Representative McDonald.
Correct.
Sorry, I couldn't see your
Ms.
sign.
Ms. Early.
Thank you. I think that there's a couple of issues that go along with that. Is one, we're not looking at the statute comprehensively in subdivision 5 of 122A.40 and 122A.41. The issue that we have in here is that schools have, like Ms. Luger-Nicolai mentioned, is that they have 3 years to examine the probationary period of most teachers. Some teachers come to us with 3 years established of continuing contract status or tenure status. When they come into the district, we have one year to examine them during the probationary period. So if we have a teacher coming in and we have an established 60 days is all they need to have in order to establish their probationary period, that's all the time that schools are going to have to examine them to make sure that their performance is appropriate. And if we don't make those examinations within that time period that they're there, they could be there for just 60 days. And then they could go on leave, which this bill would allow. So let's say we have a teacher come in, they are there for 60 days, they go on a leave for the remaining portion of the school year. We've had a very short period of time to examine that teacher's status. So we get around to the time of the school year in April and May when we're looking at renewals and non-renewals of teachers that would establish continuing contract. This is a teacher that we're going to have basically for the rest of our lives unless we can establish grounds for immediate discharge or a mutual resignation. This is all the time we've had to look at a teacher to see if their performance is appropriate, if they've met our standards, and it's really hard to get those evaluations done within that time period. If we don't do them within that time period, we don't know if somebody is going to be requesting a leave and be taking off during that time. We have a number of probationary employees that are coming into our schools. We have administrators that are struggling right now. We have to get 3 evaluations done during the probationary period. If they're only there for 60 days or they're only there for a short period of time, we don't have the ability to get that done. We need to establish a baseline that gives schools enough time to have that opportunity to evaluate them in order to attain that continuing contract status. And that's why that 120 days has been very beneficial to schools. It's helped them retain teachers, because what schools do when they don't have that opportunity to properly evaluate the teachers is they don't renew them, and they're gone. And that teacher could be a very great teacher, and we have lost that ability. But it's a huge risk to provide that continuing contract status to a teacher that we don't know what their capabilities and issues might be. So we found that valuable. It's been sticking in the law for 12 years. It's been working really well. And to go back without saying why 60 days is a better time period, we already have provisions in the statute that account for the continuing contract status of teachers who leave for military service, medical leave, family leave, and they provide that they don't lose their continuing status, because you have to have not just a year of probationary service, you have to have continuous connecting service. You can't have a break in service. They're not losing that break in service already by the statutory provisions are there. I don't know why we're jumping backward, I guess is the question. I don't understand the reason. My clients don't understand the reason. And that's why I think it would be very helpful to coordinate with Representative Jordan, talk about these issues, why we're here, and why that would be beneficial to schools, because we don't understand.
And Ms. Early, Ms. Representative Jordan has said she's willing to look at this, and so that'd be something to, going forward, when it gets to education, that to work on this and meet and confer on that and try and come up with what might be a better number than 60 or 120. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thank you very much, Ms. Early and Representative Jordan. In your earlier testimony, you said you want to get the bill right, and it sounds like that you're willing to work with their organization and get the bill right, and I think that's a good law practice and good governance. So I'm anxious to see how this progresses. One last item then.
Representative McDonald.
Representative Jordan, in subsection 8, section 15, subsection 8, regarding the data practicing, the current law is you can opt out of the information. But in your language, you will put into statute that they must provide the information to the union. Now, members, we already got this green book. I just read it today. I looked at everybody's pictures in our house, and really nice pictures. We have a good-looking group here in the state legislature, House members, and your occupations and everything. And I noticed, because of my lack of due diligence, I left my phone number in there, which I wanted to take out 4 years ago. But the picture's good because I look a little younger. But I noticed some of you folks also opted out to put your phone numbers in and your occupation or an address, which is probably a wise thing to do. So, Representative Jordan, I do have an issue. We do have an issue, and I heard some testimony have some issues regarding that subsection 8, regarding that they must provide that information to the union, their home address, their phone numbers, their email, their job title, the location where they work, telephone numbers, personal cell numbers, date of hire, work emails. I have personally, and I don't like to be personally, I think there's a problem with this, and I think my colleagues agree, and certainly does some of your testifiers, that I would hope you consider or at least respond to why you want to put in state statute the legislature forcing people to give that information.
And Representative McDonald, I'll let Representative Jordan answer, but that's a data,
not our purview?
A data issue that would be the purview of the Judiciary Committee. And so, but Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative McDonald. Yes, that will be addressed in a subsequent amendment that will be attached to the bill in the Judiciary Committee.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jordan, if you want to repeat what you said, I think. Representative Jordan.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That will be addressed in a subsequent amendment in the Judiciary Committee. But it's important to remember that unions do have to work for everyone, whether or not they pay dues. And so unions do need to be able to have that contact information for people who they may need to represent, even if they are not a member of that union.
Representative McDonald.
I would disagree. I don't think the unions need that information, personally. I think that's the information that should be a choice by the employee. It's not a need, but that's my personal choice, and I think I have some agreement here in the audience and on this side of the aisle. But I'm appreciative that you're going to address that issue in the next committee and perhaps have it opt out.
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, I didn't hear a question, but
yeah.
But yes, I mean, we all have personal opinions.
Any further questions? Member questions?
Representative Byrd, I'm sorry, I don't see a corner of my eye here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question, but just maybe a follow-up to Lead McDonald's point. In my other life, I'm a flight attendant, as most of you know. I'm required to provide my airline with my current address each and every time it changes, should it change, and my phone number. I don't see any difference in having the union having access to that. There are a lot of things that a union should communicate to their members. A variety of things from contract negotiation meetings, you know, where you can come and learn, to various other sort of things that the union and company agree on together, your monthly union meetings, all that sort of thing. So it is definitely within the purview of the union to be able to have access to that. And just in terms of this bill as a whole, thank you to the author. What you have heard today from the author and from the testifiers, they are the people that take care of us. They teach our children. They feed our children. The nurses take care of us when we're most vulnerable. Even the people that take away our trash keep us on track and offer that service. So this bill is simply taking care of those who take care of us. If you think about it that way, it's really hard not to support this bill. So thank you to the author, thank you to the testifiers, and thank you for caring for those of us who are important to us.
Any further questions or comments? If Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr.
Didn't
Chair.
Look that way. Yeah. Representative Schultz.
You're fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is Section 13 within the purview of our discussion here today?
On the list I have here, yes, I believe so, yes.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Number one, before I get started or turn this back over, I just wanted to request a roll call on this bill.
Roll call is being requested. There will be a roll call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the bill author, I'm reading over Section 13 and then getting into Subdivision 9 and frankly, I guess what I'm seeing and seeking clarity on this is, are we providing access to the unions, to the email systems of the school and or whomever the employer is in this circumstance, and the protections that are therefore provided to the employees, because that's the way that I'm reading this. And
Representative, as it's provided. Can you give a line and a page and line number? On your right hand, left hand side of the bill, there should be a page and line number. You're saying 13, subdivision 9, as I read it, that's in section 16 of the bill. On
section 16, sorry.
Page 11.2.
Within our
11.2.
I know
no,
we
it's
had some
it's within
in
our,
numbers.
It's within, so. Our, it's within our thing. So if you're looking at the amendment, I'm seeing that as 11.25 in my
perfect.
Amendment.
Thank you. That sounds great, Mr. Chair.
And so that's what you're asking about.
Yes.
Representative Jordan.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill author. I see that as problematic. I see that as problematic for a third party to have access to the school system like that, or to the email system as a whole. And there certainly could be and should be other ways to do that. And so I take issue with that part of the bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Any further questions or comments? If not, Representative Jordan, if you want to wrap up, and we'll get to a vote.
Well, I think one of the best quotes of the day came from Representative Schultz, who said, "It's about time we stand up for union men and women." I agree. I want to thank members and the chair for the discussion, and I want to remind members again about how we talked about our public employees during the pandemic. We called these educators, nurses, and municipal workers heroes when they vaccinated us against a deadly virus, hauled away all of our excess boxes, and fed every single child in this state. These heroes are asking for a voice in those jobs that we desperately need them to do. Give it to them by voting for this bill. Thank you.
And with that, members, the clerk will take the roll. And I'll renew my motion. Representative Jordan, if you will, renew your motion as amended.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jordan renews her motion that House File 1690 as amended is re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Vice Chair Berg?
Aye.
Berg, aye. McDonald?
Nay.
McDonald, nay. Representative Daniels?
Nay.
Daniels, nay. Representative Greenman is excused. Representative Hill?
Aye.
Hill, aye. Representative Hussein?
Aye.
Hussein, aye. Representative Jordan?
Jordan, aye.
Jordan, aye. Representative Koslowski?
Koslowski, aye.
Koslowski, aye. Representative Meckland?
Nay.
Meckland, nay. Representative Myers?
Nay.
Myers, nay. Representative Schultz?
Nay.
Schultz, nay. Representative Wolgamott?
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye. Mr. Chair, with the conclusion of roll call, there are 7 ayes and 5 nays.
With 7 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and the bill's on its way to state government finance. Members, that concludes our agenda for today. We will be meeting again on Thursday, so hope to see everybody there. And with that, members, we are adjourned.